Hello, my name is Cynthia. I am here with Jesus doing an oral history interview for the project Undocumented Voices. It is April 23rd, 2015, and I'm here at Coeur Hall at the ASU Tempe campus. Hello, Jesus. Could you please state your name and give me your formal consent that we can use this interview?
Yeah, my name is Jesus Cisneros, and I provide you my consent.
Thank you. For starters, could you tell me something more about your personal background?
Yeah, sure. So I was born in Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico, and I came here to the United States when I was 6 years old. I didn't become naturalized until the age of 16. Almost, so it was almost a 10-year process for me to go through immigration and family immigration processes specifically, and so I consider myself one of the lucky ones, right, in the sense that my dad and I, who are the only ones that were born in Mexico, were able to be petitioned by my mother. So that's kind of a little bit of my background. There's five people in my family, and that's within my immediate family, and within my extended family, I do have relatives that are undocumented. I grew up in a predominant Latino border town, and so immigration issues were not very uncommon.
How was your experience being born and growing up in Mexico?
Yeah, so I think because I came here at such a young age and I started first grade here all the way to where I am now, I think I remember struggling at the beginning only because of I grew up in a border town, so I really moved from Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua to El Paso, Texas. And that was, I mean, the border is right between us. But I think the greatest challenge for me was coping with the stigma of being born on the other side of the border. I think even though it was a predominant Latino community in El Paso, there was this inherent stigma towards those who were born in Juarez. It's like it was almost like a class system, right? So you were less than if you were born in Juarez. And so I remember growing up hiding the fact that I was not a U.S. citizen and that I was not born in the U.S. I remember lying a lot of the time in school when people would ask where I was born or whenever we had projects like that, just because I wanted to avoid the stigma, the bullying, the harassment, and so forth that was often imposed upon, you know, immigrant children based on their accent, their skin color, and their place of birth.
How was your experience going to high school?
You know, to be honest with you, immigration or my immigrant experience, I think I just kind of repressed it, and I didn't really think about it or talk about it beyond when I was asked where I was born. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that it was a predominant Latino environment, and so it was almost taken for granted. Like, everyone had some kind of immigrant experience. And so, for me, I didn't really come to embrace my immigration story until I got to college. And that's because being in college helped me understand the value in diversity, the value in being different, and coming from a different country, coming from a different background, and so forth. And so, it really shifted from coming within a predominantly Latino environment to coming to a more diverse, predominantly white environment, but also with a strong international student presence. And so, I think that's what propelled me to really embrace, you know what, I was born in Mexico, and that's cool. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But high school, I think for me, it was just, you know, just like every other student, I didn't have to struggle or think about anything in terms of limitations, because like I said, I was lucky enough to be petitioned by my mother, and so even though that process took 10 years, I was protected through legal permanent residency, right? And so I really didn't have anything to compare to other students. I wasn't aware of undocumented students. I wasn't aware of undocumented issues, and that's partly because I was so involved with my own education. I think for me it was very important to finance my way through to college, and I think that was inculcated by my parents, what we refer to as the sacrifice, you know, that our parents make moving to another country, and with the that intent being that their children, me, my sister, my brother, and I, that we are able to get an education, obtain a career, and surpass, you know, the conditions that we were living in. We were coming from a very humble background. And part of the reason why my parents tell me that we left where I was at is because it was a very unsafe environment. We didn't really have a house. We were constantly like moving around. My dad struggled to find jobs, and my mom was working as a cashier, as a clerk within a super center. But I mean, that didn't pay the bills for five people. And so when my mom had the opportunity to become naturalized, she really took that as an opportunity to kind of bring the family over and start over within an environment that was more conducive economically to what we needed.
What kind of education did you receive?
In K-12.
Yeah, or in higher education.
Yeah. So I went to Gadsden High School in Anthony, New Mexico, and I have to say I was very blessed to always be surrounded by amazing teachers. Amazing teachers who really challenged me to think about who I was and what I contributed beyond what I was able to understand about myself at the time. And that really propelled me to think about... I always knew I wanted to go to college, but I never knew why or for what. I just knew I wanted to go to college because my parents wanted me to go to college. But I think that really pushed me into more of the engineering. That's what I went into my undergrad seeking to study. However, that was only because I was good at math, and I was told that I was good at math, and I was told that there weren't a lot of Latinos in engineering and so forth, and trying to get us into STEM fields and so forth. And even though I was good at it, it just didn't drive me, didn't fill me, it wasn't my passion. So I ended up changing my major to journalism and mass communications with an emphasis in public relations. And I think that was just kind of to give me something to do. What I found was really driving my passion was working with students on campus. So while I was at New Mexico State University, I worked as a resident assistant. So I lived on campus in the residence halls. And I did social, academic, diversity programming for students, and it was amazing. I loved it. I loved the aspect of being able to engage students, being able to organize students, right, for different purposes. And so when I found out that there was actually a career in student affairs, higher education administration, that's when I decided to pursue my master's in higher education administration, student affairs. And so for that, I went to Texas A&M University, and that's when I really became involved in student affairs, advising, and housing. That's where I worked. I went from working as a student in housing to working as a paraprofessional in housing. The thing about being at Texas A&M University is that was another cultural shift, right? Because I went from Las Cruces, New Mexico, where there's still a strong Latino presence, to College Station, Texas, where it was a lot harder to find other Latinos on campus. And so I think that's the first time that I was really able to question, you know, what am I? Because prior to that, I think I had also taken my race for granted because everyone around me looked like me. But at College Station, the majority of the people around me did not look like me. They were black or white. And I think Latinos were not as visible. And so when I was there, that's when I really started to develop my identity as a Latino, because I understood what it meant. I finally understood what it meant to be a minority, because I really was a minority. And I stood out. And yeah, it was just one of those experiences that I look back at and I wonder why it took me so long to really understand myself as a Latino and what that meant.
So that was also the time you got really interested in education.
Yeah, so education, definitely. Student affairs, I mean, that's all it is. It's about helping students develop through college, whether that's their racial identity development, their sexual identity development, their ethical, moral, and so forth. So I think even just being in that program and preparing myself to work within the field of higher education and student affairs, that helped me personally to really come into terms with my racial identity, my immigrant background, and then eventually my sexual identity as well. That's when I came out as queer, LGBTQ, and it was during my education at Texas A&M University.
When did you first became aware about the undocumented issue?
Yeah. So after I graduated from Texas A&M University, I worked in housing and residential education for about a year in Florida. And after that, I think I realized that I wasn't done with my education. I felt that what I was doing, which was administration at the time, it didn't really complete me. I knew that I liked being in the classroom. I knew that I liked working with students. And I know that the higher that you go up in administration, the less you work with students directly. And so I came back for my doctorate in education policy and evaluation because I knew that I wanted to be a professor. I knew that I wanted to be in the classroom. And I knew that I also wanted to do research that was conducive to challenging some of these environments in which we function in. And so that was here at Arizona State University. I was accepted. And when I got here, I think that was another environmental change for me, right? Because I was back in a predominantly Latino environment, at least in the community, but that demographic was not as represented at the university. And then I came to understand why that was, and that's because of the social political context of Arizona. And mind you, this was after the passage of SB 1070. And so I think at the forefront of my arrival here, I was already conscious of the fact that there was racial profiling practices, that there was a lot of allegations, that there was a lot of policing, there was targeting of Latinos specifically, but even more specifically of immigrants and undocumented immigrants more so. And so just becoming aware of these social issues drove me to really just understand. And then working within the community, as soon as I got here, I wanted to be involved because I didn't know anyone here, I didn't have family. And so I went to the Queer Undocumented Immigrant Project. And that was an organization that really brought together issues of immigration and sexual orientation, gender identity. And so being involved with this organization, that's when I really began to understand really what it meant to be a Latino within the context of Arizona, what it meant to be an immigrant within the context of Arizona, and then the limitations imposed on undocumented immigrants just based on their immigration status. And at that time, it was not being able to qualify. Well, at that time, actually, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals hadn't passed. And so that was everything from no access to in-state tuition, state-based financial aid, not even in the community college. It was not being able to work. It was not qualifying for a state ID or driver's license, as well as qualifying for state public benefits. And so coming from an immigrant background, identifying with an immigrant family, it was one of those things where it just seemed very unjust, and it seemed very targeting of specific populations. And I think social justice has always been something that has undergirded my work and my passion for being in education, and so I brought that into my studies here at ASU within the Mary Lou Fulton Teachers College, really embedding social justice specifically for immigration and LGBTQ issues into my studies, into education policy, and seeing the ways that it intersected with these social political issues. And that essentially led me and a friend to create an educational program here, which we named Dream Zone. And so Dream Zone is a program, and it's an educational workshop that we developed to increase faculty, staff, student leaders, and even the community members' knowledge of immigration issues as they impact educational processes for students, for teachers, for individuals that work with students. And so it's really trying to increase their multicultural competencies for working with students and making sure that we are providing educational success for everyone, regardless of immigration status.
What do you think are those specific tools and competencies people attain while they attend Dream Zone?
Yeah, so I think the way that we molded the program was more of becoming socially aware, becoming socially conscious and critically conscious, right? So for us, it starts with understanding where you come from and understanding where you believe these issues come from. So understanding yourself, what you believe, where these beliefs and values come from, and then really challenging them, right, beyond what we challenge ourselves every day. So it's understanding ourselves and then understanding the context in which we live in, not only the state of higher education within Arizona, but also across the country, how that impacts issues of access, of affordability, of retention, matriculation as well. And then beyond understanding the context, also understanding our responsibilities to serve as allies, right? So what is it that we can do within the scope of our positions to really assist students that we work with? At the end of the day, as higher education practitioners, student affairs professionals, we work with students here regardless of their race, religion, disability, right, ability, immigration status. And so it's important that we're competent and we're informed about issues that directly impact the lives of students. Because otherwise, we're doing a disservice to students who are paying their tuition to be here, who often don't qualify for federal financial aid, state-based financial aid, in-state tuition. And so that's already a lot of obstacles that they're jumping through to be in higher education. And so the least that we could do is provide them adequate services and support.
Who comes to Dream Zone? Who participates?
Yeah, so the majority of our participants, I have to say, are staff. So these are individuals that work within the university, outside of the university, K-12 institutions that work directly with students. A lot of it is student affairs services, but we also get some faculty that do research on these issues. We get a lot of student leaders who want to better understand these issues, and then we get a lot of graduate students as well, who I think during their graduate programs are beginning to understand these issues and incorporate them into their social justice work as well. So the majority is staff, student affairs staff, personnel, and then I would say it's students, student leaders, and then it's faculty. And of course the community is invited throughout.
Yeah. How do they experience Dream Zone?
Yeah, well, Dream Zone is a four-hour workshop, and it sounds like a really long workshop, but it's a lot of content, right? And it's not just content, it's a lot of self-reflection, it's about assessment, and it's about commitment to helping transform the campus environment, the campus climate, to be more reflective of inclusion, of social justice. And so, it's a process that we take from starting to understand ourselves to understanding our context. And then more importantly, we don't do this as advocating for students, right? We do this with students, with undocumented students. And so undocumented students are an integral part of Dream Zone. They help facilitate, they share their stories, they provide practitioners with very intentional efforts that they could do to better improve their college experiences, to improve campus climate for other immigrant students, for other undocumented students.
So it's a collaboration between the participants of Dream Zone and the undocumented students.
Absolutely. So a lot of what it provides is that opportunity for individuals who maybe are not connected to immigration directly because they're third, fourth, fifth generation immigrants, and you know, we forget our immigration story. So it's really providing an intentional effort for practitioners, for faculty, for students to interact with undocumented students who are currently going through the limitations of their immigration status.
In what way, for example, do the participants of Dream Zone help out the undocumented students?
So I think beyond just informing yourself and becoming a better ally, a lot of what we do is network building. And so we're creating a network of allies. And so the way that participants help undocumented students, both directly and indirectly, is by connecting them to resources, whether personal or professional, and or creating visibility on campus of individuals who are willing and able to talk about immigration issues, to talk about how to help individuals who are trying to apply for, you know, work study as a deferred action recipient, or how to apply to housing and residential education, you know, and other services. So it's really allowing practitioners to incorporate their everyday expertise in student affairs, student services, and connecting that to students' needs for accessing these services.
Shell, you mentioned that Dream Zone builds a whole network of allies. Is Dream Zone actively involved with any other organizations and or projects?
Yeah, so what we do is in collaboration with the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, with the Queer Undocumented Immigrant Project, as well as other local organizations, we bridge the gap between the community and higher education. So we think of Dream Zone as a knowledge mobilization initiative where we are bringing experts in their own right, undocumented immigrants who are able to talk about their experiences navigating higher education, trying to access higher education or life after higher education, right? How do you get a job and so forth? And then we supplement that with research that is done by our faculty that is respondent to immigration issues, that is respondent to the intersection of immigration and higher education issues and how it impacts the lives of students and practitioners, student affairs practitioners specifically. So we try to create shared learning environments where these conversations take place and where participants are able to take it out into their communities and share what they learned, and then hopefully invite others to come and partake in the learning.
Are you aware of how many undocumented students there are currently enrolled in Asia?
I'm not, you know, and I think the difficulty behind that is because unless someone discloses their undocumented status to you, you wouldn't know that they're undocumented or that they come from an undocumented family, right? Because I think a lot of our students, even if they are citizens, that doesn't mean their parents may be citizens or have a legal permanent residency and so forth. And so we see that with a lot of students, their parents are still undocumented. And so it's one of those issues that drives a lot of students to participate and to push for these efforts on campus. So we don't have specific numbers. We know several students, right, that help out with Dream Zone, and that's how we are able to connect with them via these spaces that we create. But in terms of specific numbers, I don't know. All I know is that over the past couple of years, those numbers have dwindled, and that's because there's been less access to financial opportunities, both private and like through donors and stuff. So it makes it a lot harder for students to pay 300% tuition as out-of-state students because they don't qualify for in-state tuition as a result of Proposition 300. And then, you know, we're currently working to try to lower that, right, to where we can get the Arizona Board of Regents to really side on the side of the morally correct thing to do, the economically correct thing to do, the socially correct thing to do, and provide in-state tuition to at least deferred action recipients who now have legal presence in the state of Arizona. And so it's almost like a loophole of Proposition 300, right? Because they're no longer undocumented. They have legal presence. And so we're trying to create opportunities for students to have access to higher education.
Could you describe your work with the Board of Regents?
Yeah. So I don't work directly with them, right? Yeah. So in my capacity as a student, a lot of what we're doing here on campus is create visibility of student support for access to higher education for undocumented students, for DACA recipients. So a lot of the mobilization that we've been doing, a lot of the organizing that we've been doing on campus has revolved around student organizations, student leaders coming out and showing support for undocumented students' access to higher education at an in-state tuition price. And so a lot of what our messaging conveys is that DACA recipients have legal presence, and so they are entitled to in-state tuition at 100% the ticket price, right, versus the 300% that they're having to pay now as out-of-state tuition. Through out-of-state tuition, I'm sorry.
Could you tell me a bit more about the recent protest you guys
organized? Yeah, so we organized a solidarity walk, and this was a couple of weeks ago, and the solidarity walk, again, was to bring student leaders and student organizations out and show visible support for in-state tuition equality for DACA recipients. And so over the past couple of months, I think organizations within the community have come out in support for these issues. I think different leaders within the community, different even leaders within the state have come out in support for in-state tuition. And so what we wanted to convey was that there are a lot of people that are in support of these issues, and we want to show you that as a student body, we also support these issues. And as you take up decisions in the next couple of months about tuition rates and so forth, we want you to know that as a student body, we collectively support in-state tuition equality for DACA recipients at 100%. And so it's really trying to demonstrate that as Sun Devils, we don't leave any Sun Devil behind, right? And we're a family, and so it's important that we convey our support of each other.
Dream Zone has been very successful over the years. Could you tell me a little bit more about how the project was received in the wider community?
Maybe? Yeah, so I think over the past, we're going on 3 years now that we've had Dream Zone at Arizona State University. Over this course, we've had over 1,300 participants go through a 4-hour workshop, and so I think that says a lot about the interest that we've received in learning about immigration and its intersection with higher education issues and even K-12 issues. It's also been received very well by K-12 institutions, so we facilitated different workshops for specific schools, for counselors within school districts, and even within teacher conferences, right? Or Teach for America has been another organization that has asked us to facilitate Dream Zone for their core of teachers here locally in Arizona. And so we've been able to embed Dream Zone within a lot of our community work, our on-campus work, and then even out of state. So Dream Zone has been a workshop that we've implemented at other state universities. So the University of Nevada in Las Vegas, Colorado State University, Fort Collins, New Mexico State University. And we've also shared our curriculum with other institutions, right? So that they can have their own student leaders implement similar type workshops based off of our curriculum, our success, and even our model, right? And so it's really amazing to see similar programs take root in other institutions of higher education and even K-12 institutions, right? So it's been very exciting for us to see how higher education leaders have really taken a stance to support and stand with undocumented students and advocate on behalf of tuition equality in many of these states, which currently doesn't exist.
More specifically, in March 2013, Dream Zone was in the national spotlight after winning the Sweet 16 bracket competition of the Clinton Global Initiative University. So could you tell me a bit more about that competition as well?
Yeah, I forgot about that. So this was maybe going on 3 years already. Like 2 years ago, I think, my co-founder and I, we submitted a proposal for the Clinton Global Initiative. And so this is a program that seeks to provide local solutions to global problems. And so we submitted Dream Zone as a response to the educational inequalities that we saw, to the anti-immigrant social political context that we live in. And so it was really seeking to just bridge the gap between higher education in the community, and this by providing accessible information, knowledge mobilization efforts, and making research accessible, making knowledge accessible to community members, to higher education practitioners, and so forth. We were selected as a top 16 finalist based on some rubric that they use, I don't know. And so part of that challenge for us went to... So what happened is after we were selected as a top 16 finalist, as like the best, most innovative solutions, it went out to the public. And so the public got to choose their favorite solutions to these social issues. And so then after that, we made top 8, you know, based on the public's votes and people voting online, this nationally, right? And then we made top 4. And then we won. We got first place for the Clinton Global Initiative. And it was very exciting for us because it really affirmed the work that we were doing. And it affirmed the interest, not only amongst students, even though this is like a college, essentially a college student population that's responding to these issues, but also just nationally. It really spoke to the need for these type of interventions within educational institutions, both K-12 and higher education.
How do you see the future of Dream Zone evolving?
So right now, I think our conversations are going to how do we institutionalize this program or similar type programs within the university so that it's not reliant on the volunteerism and the passion of students, you know? One thing I didn't say before is that Dream Zone started as a student-led initiative, and to a certain extent it still is. Many of us are still students. Some of us are also... we play different roles within the university. Some of us work as staff. Some of us work as adjunct faculty, right, within specific classes. And so we don't get paid to do these educational workshops, you know. And to date, we've done, I think the last number was 56. We've done 56 total workshops within the university. And that's not including workshops that we facilitate for specific groups outside of the university. Which has also been many, many workshops. And so it's great that we have such an active group that is passionate about these issues and that's willing to commit their time, their energy, their passion into fulfilling the mission of Dream Zone. But I think in line with economic justice, right, it's also about how do we institutionalize these type of efforts so that we can also pay individuals that are doing this work, because it's exhausting, right? And it's a lot of time that we put into this work, and it's self-gratifying. I think the work speaks for itself, and it's great to feel like you're making an impact in someone else's life, even if it's just one person or a whole group of 40, which, you know, is typically the size that we work with. But I think more than that, I think it's being smart about how to do this work and how to build capacity and increase the number of workshops that we can facilitate. Because right now we're a small group of, I believe, 5 people. And so for 5 people, I think we've done a really great job until now. And so how do we build capacity moving forward?
Are you involved with any other organizations or projects besides the Dream Zone?
On campus, I'm part of several student organizations, and I think that's what I utilize, right, as a student, like my student capacity. So I was president of the Latino Graduate Student Alliance on campus. I'm the vice president of the Graduate and Professional Student Association. And then I also participate in other student groups in just a member basis, right? But I think using my roles within these positions, within these organizations, I'm sorry, it has also been an opportunity to engage our membership in increasing our consciousness about these social issues. So really supporting other efforts on campus that other student organizations are doing, or even that Dream Zone is doing, and supporting it with our membership from these organizations so that we can start mobilizing other students who are within our graduate programs, who are within our classrooms and so forth. So it's really putting a student face to these issues.
And off campus?
And off campus, the Queer Undocumented Immigrant Project, Familia Trans Queer Liberation Movement, And then I also support efforts from Arcoiris, as well as United We Dream. So,
could you tell me a bit more about the second organization you mentioned?
So Familia, Transqueer Liberation Movement, is an organization based out of California. And so what they're doing is, over the past year, they've kind of built small, I don't want to say chapters because it's not chapters, but small pockets of activists, of leaders that are Latino. So this is intersecting more Latino and LGBTQ issues, but part of many of our Latino experience is immigration, and so we talk about immigration a lot, right? So working with them has been also an opportunity to learn about transgender issues, right, within immigration detention centers, about, you know, the criminalization of LGBTQ members, the criminalization of undocumented immigrants within state laws and policies, the inhumane practices, you know, dragnet policing, immigration enforcement policies. And so I think being involved with these different organizations in the community, and even the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, right, it makes all of this more real, beyond just research, beyond just talking about issues theoretically or conceptually. I think it also puts the face of individuals who are directly affected by this. And that's what makes this work powerful, that you are helping individuals by helping change the environment, the climate.
How do you feel about the current legislation that is available for undocumented people? So, for example, DACA.
I think DACA was a great first step towards allowing individuals to, eligible individuals, right? Because it's very selective. But it's a great first step for helping them work, for relieving some of the fear of deportation that a lot of our community faces. But like I said, it's very limited in scope, right? It only benefits individuals who came here before the age of 16, you know, your dreamers. It helps dreamers. And while that's great, I think it also creates different categories of undocumented immigrants now, right? Because in saying that dreamers are more deserving of some type of relief, you're automatically positioning their parents and anyone who's not a dreamer as undeserving. And so it becomes politics of deservingness, right? So who's a good immigrant and who's a bad immigrant? And so I think that's part of the problem that we're facing today, that it's a continual criminalization of our community, even through positive efforts like DACA or the expansion of DACA or the DAPA, right, which hasn't been implemented either. But I think these are great steps, but I think more great would be finding ways in which we can create greater inclusion of our community. And then beyond that, also not criminalizing our community, right? Because we have to understand that being undocumented alone, being LGBTQ, and even the intersection of these two issues, one, prior to DACA, a lot of our community wasn't able to work, you know? And so there was different issues. There was different means of survival that drove people to the informal economy, you know, sex works, survival sex, right? And then access to hormone therapy, to different things, right? And this is specific to, like, LGBTQ issues, right, within the undocumented community. But having to survive via these means because you don't have a pathway to citizenship, because you don't have a pathway to work or to safety, right, which is, I think, what undergirds all this, that criminalizes you even further, because that's what pushes people, that's what exposes our community to police, you know, to detention and so forth. And so simply having that on your record disqualifies you for DACA, or any type of relief, right, that's currently been proposed. And so how do we destigmatize, you know, detention and prison within our community, understanding that these are the consequences of learning to survive within the environment in which we've pegged undocumented immigrants.
Do you support comprehensive immigration reform?
Absolutely. I think everyone should have a pathway to citizenship and the opportunity, regardless of their criminal record, regardless of the age that they came into the U.S., and regardless of their sexual orientation, sexuality. So, absolutely.
How do you see the future for Arizona evolving?
You know, I think for Arizona to transform into a more inclusive environment, we have to do away with policy that is restrictionist and that directly targets undocumented immigrants. So SB 1070, the local enforcement of federal immigration policies the effects of it are more detrimental than I think the intended, the intent behind passing SB 1070. Same with Proposition 300. I mean, what sense does excluding a large population of our state, undocumented immigrants, from higher education, how much sense does that make to the state economy, to our society? Whether we want to or not, undocumented immigrants will always be part of our communities. And so we live in the state. We all share the community. We all share the state economy. What sense does it make to exclude them from access to higher education, where they can get a degree, obtain a career, you know, contribute to the economy in like higher levels than they're able to without an education? And then, of course, that also means finding a pathway to legalization for them as well, so that they're able to put their degrees into practice. And I think that extends beyond DACA, because DACA is a two-year program, and at any point it could end, and then everyone's undocumented again. And so it's not a permanent solution.
But you see the future evolving for the best.
I think with the leaders that we have in the state, and I think the passion that many of us carry, I see us changing policy to reflect the needs of our communities in very positive ways. Because we will continue to challenge anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ policies that directly target us.
Okay, well, then thank you for this interview, Jesus.
No, you're welcome.